I just want to mention before we get started that this show is about the female body. So the conversation is honest and candid. Nothing too out there. The grown-ups can handle it, but we just thought you should know. Okay, here we go. The science writer Rachel Gross says there comes a time in every woman's life when her body bumps up against the limits of human knowledge. And it's in that moment when she sees herself in the same way as hundreds of years of medicine has seen her. There's a mystery. Her own moment like this came a few years ago. She had an infection down there. Her vagina itched terribly, and she couldn't get any relief. So naturally, she went to her gynecologist.
We're on pretty good terms. She's very professional and businesslike with my vagina. And she would offer me like antibiotics 1 week. And then at one point, she just said, "I don't have anything for you." And she had just told me this was the most common type of infection, like women get all the time, but there was nothing really to be done about it. I was like, what? And she eventually said, there is one other option. Don't freak out. If you look it up on the internet, it's going to say it's rat poison. And it is. But this works for some women. It's called boric acid. It's these suppositories that you put up there. And the best we know is that it sort of levels the vaginal environment and gives you like a clean slate. I was obviously horrified that it was suggested to women to put rat poison in their vaginas. But I went and I got it, and it was like a pill case with a skull and crossbones that said poison in all capital letters. And I just felt kind of like ashamed picking it up. And I am a person with very little shame who loves to talk about all my lady parts. Then what happened next is a bit more unusual. One night, I woke up in the middle of the night and was really exhausted. And I realized I hadn't done my boric acid thing. And I went to the bathroom and the pills look just like antibiotics. They're like plastic sheaths with like powder in them. So I picked it up and I guess I forgot what I was doing and I swallowed it. I was absolutely freaking out. Like my heart has never been beating that fast before. I ended up in the ER thinking I was going to get my stomach pumped or not like knowing what the heck I had put in my digestive tract and why it was okay to put it in my reproductive tract. So it turns out you have to have a lot of boric acid to poison yourself, fortunately. So the worst that I was going to get was just a little gas, the doctor said, and gave me some crackers and applesauce. And I guess that was really what started me thinking about how much I didn't know about my own body, because I didn't know anything about BV, anything about my vaginal microbiome, anything about why this would help versus antibiotics, and how little people that were supposed to know about my body knew about my body. I heard the phrase a lot from scientists that the female reproductive system is a, quote, black box. That's like kind of how I felt. Like I just had this opaque situation going on that no one knew what to do with, and people just gave the impression that it was totally normal and usual for bad things to happen in your reproductive system and for you to have itching and pain every now and then, that like this is just how female bodies go. They're just prone to these problems. So I did feel like my body wasn't my own at that point. I didn't really know how to care for it, and I couldn't visualize what was happening inside it. And it sounded like there must be a lot of people with these questions, these very basic questions. This is kind of what convinced me that I really wanted to spend the next 3 years looking into these questions.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So this was the moment Rachel Gross says her book was born, this realization that she knew almost nothing about how her vagina worked. The subtitle says her book is an anatomical voyage, and not just how, for example, the clitoris actually works and is shaped, but the history of how science for hundreds of years got it wrong. Gross told us when she started reporting the book and was talking to female researchers and scientists about their work and their own questions about their own anatomy, she started to see a recurring theme. Women who didn't feel like they knew their own bodies.
They were searching for more knowledge and for some authority that could help them understand what's happening to them, but it didn't exist. And that really struck me as weirdly, a sort of universal experience for all the women, including anyone who identifies as a woman or people who don't identify as women but have a lot of these reproductive organs that I'm talking about, they had each had this similar feeling. I really wanted the book to have the effect of making people feel more empowered and knowledgeable, even if it was literally knowing why we don't know all this stuff about our own bodies.
Yeah. And there's that connection you write about between that you, it seems as you were uncovering all of this, that you discovered that connection between the way women's bodies are marginalized and the way women in science are marginalized. There's a connection there.
Oh, yeah. It almost feels like it's too simple, especially if you think of science as being kind of all-knowing and all-seeing. And, you know, we ask all these different types of questions and try to be agnostic about the answers. But really what I saw again and again, especially in the history of science bits, were there were many white male scientists from a specific background who really didn't ask any questions about bodies that weren't like theirs, or they went with the assumptions from earlier eras. And it was as simple as it took a woman getting into that field to start asking these basic questions.
The language here is complicated. And as you point out, it's inadequate. The female reproductive system doesn't really cut it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I had no idea I would spend so many nights staying up and worrying about terminology and like vagina versus vulva or like woman versus female, but I did. So that female reproductive system sounds on the surface very objective and medical. And I definitely used it in like my book proposal and talking about this book, but it turns out that a lot of the book is about pleasure, identity, sexuality, and these other themes that are wrapped up in some of these body parts. And reproductive system has its own bias. It says that these parts are made for baby making, and that's what's important about them. And it actually, I think, echoes the historical focus of research on fertility and infertility, which I go into a little bit in the book.
Well, this idea, and this is an important theme in the book, that our scientific understanding of the female body is, as you say, built off the study of male bodies. Mm-hmm. And say a little bit more about that, because you also mentioned that until quite recently, most medical research on women in this country was centered on fertility, seen through the lens of reproduction.
Yeah. So it feels very ancient, this idea that the male body is kind of the standard or the template. But that is how research was done in this country until at least the 80s. In many cases, that bias still exists. There's still that idea that, well, women have hormonal fluctuation and menstruation, and they might skew the research, which has been shown not to be true. And I think this actually is related to the other thing you mentioned, that any research on women is often centered on fertility. So one thing I found was that there is a gynecological branch in the NIH now. So it's like studies vulvas and these body parts throughout the lifetime, but it's still in the Child Health and Development Institute. So it's still underneath the auspices of baby making and fertility, which is kind of crazy. And that's also only been around since, I think, 2012.
Let's talk about, as you do in the book early on, the history of some of these biases, which gets us to Hippocrates, of course, the most revered, I guess, of the Greek physicians. Mm-hmm. Never actually, you say, studied a female body.
Definitely not that we know of, and very unlikely. It was taboo at the time for male physicians to study female bodies. There are like religious and cultural barriers to that, so I'm not blaming him. But he wrote that he learned from midwives and, you know, maybe some sexual partners. We honestly don't know, but we do know he made a lot of weird assumptions.
Galen, his anatomical model that he drew, he just basically left out the clitoris completely.
Yes. Yeah. So not all of these old Greek philosophers left out the clitoris, but he definitely did. And he was the one who used this model where he said women were inside out men whose parts were inferior, more imperfect, and tucked up inside. Mm-hmm. So the vagina, or possibly the uterus, was an inside out penis, and the ovaries were inside testicles. So in that model, you didn't really have much room for a clitoris.
But did that also reflect a kind of, because this is something you mention in the book, that for the Greeks, how did you put it? That this idea reflected for the Greeks, you say, this idea of a divine order in which women were forever inferior, forever imperfect, inside out, I guess, even.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think my point there is that they already had these assumptions in mind when they started doing the science, to the extent that they were doing dissection or any observational science. I think Aristotle did find a clitoral mound in rats. But this theme that I repeat a lot is that you see what you expect to see. Right. And so you have this religious or cultural or political framework, and then you bring that to the table no matter how much you try to be objective.
I was also struck by how the word or variation of the word shame comes up all the time when you're talking about female genitalia, or at least the way it was talked about. Hippocrates called genitals the shame parts. A French anatomist referred to the clitoris as the shameful member. The German word for labia, shame lips. This comes up a lot.
I was also surprised by that. When I was going through the research, the word that continuously popped up was shame. And it was in too many different cultures and eras to be one person's idea or a coincidence. So yeah, Hippocrates definitely called the genitals of both sexes the shame parts. And later on, you got the word pudendum, which is a word for the vulva now. It was a word for both outer genitals, men and women. And it also means the parts for which you should be ashamed. And until less than a year ago, it was still in the official global medical dictionary, and it's still in all the gynecological textbooks that I have at home and all the anatomy books, partly because it takes so long for textbooks to change. But it just struck me, this is in the medical language, the technical language, and it might not affect the average woman who goes to the doctor and doesn't know what this word means, but there's got to be a way in which this affects our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with the medical system. And this is how doctors are learning the names of these parts, even if it's just breezed over. It's at the bottom of these textbooks. It says that this word means the part for which you should be ashamed. No comment otherwise.
So there are, throughout the book, there are these really great characters, amazing women and men as well in the story. Let's start with Marie Bonaparte. She's a princess. You begin this chapter in 1927. She's just made, as you say, the most dramatic decision of her life. She's going to go have this experimental operation. Talk a little bit about this decision that she's going to make and introduce us to her. She's a great character.
Marie Bonaparte totally compelled me, and I became obsessed with her for over a year once I learned about her. She is the great-grandniece of Napoleon, and she did end up becoming the princess of Greece and Denmark through marriage. But I guess importantly, she was a noblewoman in the interwar era in France, and she always wanted to be a doctor, but because she had this upbringing and was supposed to marry someone of a certain status, she never pursued that dream. So later in her life, she was kind of unfulfilled by motherhood, and she was sexually frustrated, and she wanted to understand what was going on in her mind and her body.
Her body refused to obey her mind.
Right. Yeah. So she's so complex. I have so many feelings about her because she asked questions no one else was willing to ask in her time. And she did things that nobody could do, but she made a lot of wrong turns, and she was definitely flawed and imperfect. So she was definitely an acolyte of Freud. She used her connections to meet him and eventually become a psychoanalyst herself. And she both absorbed and then debated with him his famous idea of the vaginal orgasm. So this was the idea that a woman has two erogenous zones, her clitoris and her vagina, and it is inappropriate and immature to the adult female to be attached to her clitoral pleasure. And so at some point she must transfer her orgasm from her clitoris to her vagina, which, to be clear, is biologically impossible. And Freud was not a biologist by this point, and yet he told women this was their problem. So this is what Marie thought she was dealing with. She thought she had trouble orgasming during penetrative sex because she was attached to her like masculine side, her phallus, which is what she referred to her clitoris as, and there was something psychologically wrong with her, and she needed to learn to make that switch. She tried psychoanalysis for years, and she really worked hard on this. And eventually she decided, you know what? The problem's not in my mind. The problem is my anatomy. And this was like completely against everything Freud believed. He, you know, said the famous words, anatomy is destiny. Like, you don't change your anatomy. Like, this is what you're born with. This is what you fall in line with. And she said, I don't think so. I'm just going to develop an operation, and I'm going to move my clitoris a little bit so that it is where I want it to be and get stimulated when I want it to be, because I can use modern medicine for this.
Yeah, because anatomy didn't get it right. We can shift it. We can move it around. Surgery will help.
Right. She thought, like, instead of trying to realign my mind in a way that's clearly not working, why don't I just shift the physical? Because that seemed possible. It did not work out so well.
No.
No. But she did some amazing research on the way to developing this surgery, which is just crazy in itself that she did that. So she was able to publish papers under her male pseudonym in medical journals, where she interviewed, I think, 100 women going to their gynecology appointments. She asked them about their sex lives, their anatomy. She measured their genitals, just stuff that would have been completely impossible for someone without her connections and status.
We should mention, as you write about her growing up, her nurse caught her masturbating and made her wear some weird nightgown contraption that made it difficult for her to touch herself. Would you just sort of talk about this era? I mean, her nurse is, you know, profoundly Catholic. Mm-hmm. And there were other kinds of contraptions for other, you know, for Catholics and other faiths. And then there was surgery also to the sort of nervous disorders, hysteria, this idea that the – and the clitoris, again, demonized and dismissed. Just talk about this time period.
So weirdly, as I did research for different eras throughout the book, it seemed like in different centuries, often you would get a new surgery in vogue that was to remove some part of the female reproductive system that would better control her behavior. And before Marie Bonaparte, it was ovaries. And by the time she came around, there was this obsession with the clitoris as being, yeah, inappropriately masculine, part of lesbian sexuality, part of child sexuality, stuff that nobody wanted to deal with. And you ended up having doctors develop surgeries to cut off the external clitoris. So this is extremely similar to a lot of forms of what the West calls female genital cutting. It's definitely like there's parallels to non-consensual surgeries on intersex children, but it's a more like hidden history that we don't talk about. One of the craziest details from that is that this surgery was developed in England and it kind of went out of vogue, but it really caught on in America. And John Harvey Kellogg, who, yes, is the founder of Kellogg Corn Flakes, was also a doctor. And he was like absolutely against child masturbation. And he recommended using acid on the clitoris and, you know, like doing anything to get kids to stop touching themselves. So this idea appealed to a lot of people at the time, and I think it went beyond specific faiths.
What was Marie's mistake? She thought of her clitoris as just basically a diminutive penis, you say, but she way underestimated that, as you put it in the book, the clitoris reigns over this vast subterranean kingdom. you write the clitoris is an underwater volcano. That's this edifice, you say, of sensory material. What was she underestimating? What was the misunderstanding that seemed to exist for hundreds of years?
And so this is how I see it, as her misunderstanding. You could also say that she could have tried other positions and stuff. But basically, that is how the clitoris was thought of, was as, like you said, a very diminutive penis, just this little, like, I hate this word, but the word nub or like pee is often used. But that's literally the part you see in touch, is just the glands, which is equivalent to the head of the penis. So just think about how much else there is. And the clitoris, the difference is that a lot of it is underneath the surface. And it's this super unique shape that I knew nothing about when I started researching this book. And it kind of like doesn't show well in textbooks. Like I have a lot of 3D models because it really helps me get the sense of depth and 3D-ness. So you have this glands and then an actual shaft that goes back into the pelvis. And then you get two arms that kind of flare back against the pubic bone, up to 3.5 inches each. And then beneath that is two bulbs, kind of like 3D teardrops that hug the vagina and the urethra. And all of this is made of erectile tissue, pretty much exactly the same as the columns of erectile tissue in the penis. So they grow and swell, and they're a really like complex collective of tissues, system of tissues that interact with all the other nearby organs and body parts.
You quote one transgender woman in the book who put it this way: nature offers a smorgasbord of possibilities.
Yeah, that's Joan Roughgarden, and she's a biologist, and I think a lot of people focused on her gender identity when her book on this came out, which was Evolution's Rainbow. And they claimed that she was biased because of where she was coming from. And I think that's both like super ironic and very inappropriate because, I mean, do we not think that Darwin was not biased by his era, his privilege, his sex, the color of his skin? Like, what I really find is that it is a strength having people come from marginalized backgrounds or people that are seeing things that most scientists do not. She really had some original ideas there that I thought were fascinating.
Rachel Gross, she's the former digital science editor of Smithsonian Magazine. Her new book is Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is your essential connection to Utah on the air and online. Because we care about our community, we want to connect wherever you are. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and let us know what local issues are important to you. Get the latest from KUER in your feed by following us on social media. Learn more at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the science journalist Rachel Gross is with us talking about her new book, Vagina Obscura. And here's how she herself has described it. It's the story of how early anatomists mapped our lady parts and how a new generation is wresting them back. Gross says much of our scientific understanding of female bodies is built on the study of male bodies. So the book is about how dynamic and fascinating these bodies can be, but also it's about how science has defined women in the past. You mentioned in the book when it comes to understanding the clitoris, all roads lead to Helen O'Connell. Talk about her medical school training, because she comes upon this, she kind of has this transformational moment where she's reading this anatomy book that describes parts of female genitalia as a failure of male genital formation.
Yeah.
Just to sort of explain what's going on and how she gets really interested in a different view of the clitoris.
Helen actually sent me the original page from her medical school book that said that. And she had like underlined a bunch of times those kind of phrases, like poor homologue, failure to develop, or like inferior, and clearly was very angry about it as a young medical student, as one should be. So yeah, she was in medical school and she noticed that there would be all these pages on the anatomy of the penis, and it would go very in depth into the nerves and blood vessels. And the clitoris was either omitted from some of the images or mentioned in that way as this poor homologue. You know, she thought that's not right. And she ultimately became the first female urologist in Australia. And that made it really clear to her that this field, which like not everyone knows, but there's a lot of female patients who get surgeries around the urethra, the vulva. Urological surgery is very important for women. And yet no one in this field had been trained in clitoral anatomy. So they were doing surgeries like removing pelvic mesh or urethral surgeries, but they didn't know where the nerves and veins were. And this really disturbed Helen.
Yeah. She basically is one of the first to really put aside this idea, Freud's idea, that the vagina and the clitoris were separate. She coins the term the clitoral complex. And you mention in the book also how her findings, you say, radiated out into the culture. Explain that part too, because you say sex educators and artists and academics, they start to, you say, reimagine the shape of female pleasure.
To be clear, like there were anatomists who had a really good idea of this anatomy in the 1800s and earlier. And like she found some of them. George Cobelt is one of the most famous now. And he did these beautiful pen and ink drawings where he put dye in the blood vessels and he showed pretty much the whole human clitoris. But that information never stuck. It kept getting lost or just wasn't considered important enough to follow up on. So it just never made it outside of these niches. And I think Helen O'Connell kind of got this knowledge into the mainstream, and she used really modern tools that nobody had in the 1800s. So she was using microdissection and MRI studies and kind of putting these together to get this whole view that really emphasized how extensive this organ was. I think a lot of headlines said it's 10 times as big as most people think. It's no little hill, but it's a mountain. And I think that really got people's attention. Yeah, it is remarkable. I mean, that's how I originally, I think, found Helen's work, was through some of the art made of the clitoris, where there were like models and sculptures and jewelry of this unique shape. And I was like, how can this be that I never learned that this shape is inside us, and all these artists have this information they're working off of? Where did it come from? And pretty quickly you realize where it originally came from.
Yeah. What did Helen O'Connell discover about the so-called G-spot? This comes up in the book. I mean, she figures it's more an idea, of course, than an actual anatomical thing, but the G-spot is one of the myths that's out there. We talk about this part.
Yeah, this was a fascinating rabbit hole for me. Again, like just like the scientists in this book, I come at this from my own limited, unique perspective. So my experience was reading women's health magazines that said, like, this is how you find your G-spot. And like, once you have it, you'll have these kind of orgasms and like, you're really missing out. And it was so weird because it was like, did someone make this up? Why is everyone repeating this information? So when I started looking into it and into Helen's work on it, I realized that no, like they didn't make it up. There were observations back in the 50s that there was like a kind of sensitive area that's a couple inches up in some women on the belly side of the vagina. And it was eventually deemed a spot, which I think was the unfortunate development. But what Helen did was she decided to do her very meticulous dissection and see what kind of tissues were there, which is like remarkable that no one had really done that before. And she found that what people were referring to as the G-spot was actually what I call the root of the clitoris. So where those bulbs and arms come together, they're sort of like the center of the wishbone. Mm. And it wraps around both the urethra and the vagina. And that's the exact like angle it's at on the front side. So for some people, they might have more sensitivity. They might notice a different type of feeling there, but it's not a button. It's like, right. So it's not like a landmark and it's not a unique anatomical spot. It's the interaction of the clitoris and other tissues and probably some glands.
And it was an idea that just, as you say in the book, made women over the years feel pressure to have a certain kind of sexual experience.
Yeah, I think the G-spot meant a lot of different things to different people. And again, this is something I can't fully comment on, but I think it was really important to a lot of lesbian women and women who were having the experience and wanted it to be validated and wanted their pleasure to be more specifically referred to. Mm. But on the other hand, what other women found was that it could feel like just another thing you had to do, another mountain you had to scale to have proper female sexuality. And so I kind of connected that to the vaginal orgasm idea.
Let's talk about Patty Brennan, another remarkable figure in the book. Mm-hmm. Tell the story. She has this really important moment where she starts to become interested in how remarkable and what an amazing structure the vagina is. But her interest starts with this insight about bird penises. Do you want to say something about her?
Yes. I love that story. Patty is a biologist. She's at Mount Holyoke. She was originally from Columbia. And she had studied marine animals and was moving on to birds one summer. And she was looking at the great tinamou, which is a like ground-dwelling little brownish bird. And she's looking at like male-female sexual relations. And at one point, she saw a male start to like mount a female, and it had like a long, like spiraling noodly thing coming out of it. She was super shocked, and she was like, is that a parasite? What's going on here? And that was when she realized that some birds had penises, very few, like a few percent of birds. That got her thinking, like, how had she'd at that point spent 2 years studying birds at Cornell, and she'd never heard of a bird penis, and she never learned about this physiology of reproduction in birds with penises and vaginas. So that got her started trying to understand both halves and how they interact. And it turned out most of the science was like, hey, look at this super long bird penis. It's 19 mm-hmm. inches, crazy. But then nobody described the female half or how they work together.
Yeah. And that was her insight, I guess. That was her contribution, is she started looking at, as you say in the book, both sides of the sex act, how they worked together. And she noticed that adaptation, natural selection, how that was involved. And she wondered, this was sort of gets us to Darwin, what he missed, because he missed this, I guess, or something was in place that kept him from realizing this part of the equation, I guess.
She was definitely interested in like sexual evolution. So what forces are acting on males and females to create these sides of the equation and the behavior they're doing. And this is something that Darwin, you know, he is rightly held up as this completely far-seeing visionary scientist who really, his strength was putting together huge amounts of data from a ton of different species to get at these basic tenets of how evolution works. He actually wrote a 1,000-page monograph on barnacle penises at one point.
Right.
So he did have stuff to say about the penis. He didn't say as much about genitals in general. People definitely say some of it was Victorian prudishness and what could get published. And some of it was, he thought that sexual selection applied to showy traits and behaviors that got you a mate rather than what happens once you get a mate and mate with them. So what he missed was that there's a whole nother step of sexual evolution happening when species copulate. So there's the egg and sperm level. There's a lot of decisions, you might say, that are going on in the female body about what happens to a male sperm. And there are a huge variety of genitals, which he didn't make any comment on.
He sort of felt that the female was the duller, chaste sex.
Mm-hmm. I pretty much said that in many, many different times. He said, he almost went so far as to say women are less evolved than men. But he definitely said that men are more creative, active, intelligent. Women were more passive, essentially. And that colored the way he thought about sexual traits, what he called sexual traits. So, he gave us the idea of male peacocks are showy and beautiful because they have to perform for female peacocks. And he kind of wrote off humans as a weird exception where females somehow became more beautiful, unclear why, but they're still more passive and not as smart. So that's part of why he never maybe looked at female genitals.
So what's Patty Brennan's kind of response to all of that? Because you say in the book that Brennan thinks of the penis and the vagina evolution as this dialogue, and it really complicates the story, it seems.
Yeah, and she wasn't the first to look at this. So there were scientists that set the stage for this, but I think she really gave the vagina its due, where she was really investigating it pretty systematically in all these different species and looking at ones that had these super unusual and interesting adaptations. So one reason the duck vagina was so interesting to her was that it is this complex kind of labyrinth with dead ends, and it seems like the ability to have some sperm go and die in a corner and other sperm be stored and picked up. And so it looks like there are a lot of decisions being made at that level that nobody would have guessed or seen if they didn't look there.
Yeah. So Brennan is looking in a far more sort of complicated, and others are looking at the vagina in a far more dynamic, complicated way. And you write about these other imaginative possibilities when it comes to the vagina. And you wonder, what if you look beyond just reproduction? What are you getting at there?
This is something that I pushed Patty on a lot because I noticed that she did focus a lot on sexual conflict. So this is, where the female and male evolutionary goals are a bit different. So they are in conflict with each other. But there's a ton of examples where that isn't the case in the animal kingdom. And there's just a lot of experiences and behavior that cannot be explained simply by males need to find females, need to make babies.
Yeah.
And one of those is homosexual sex and pairings in the animal kingdom, which are extremely common and which Darwin's evolutionary theories kind of just leave out as this is just a weird exception, or we're not going to focus on this, or there must be something else going on that ultimately has to do with sexual reproduction. So I did talk to other a primatologist and another biologist who had some fascinating theories that I had never thought of, and I think people hadn't really looked at, which is there are really important same-sex bonds that happen with dolphins, bonobos, other animals, and that too can shape genital evolution. The types of sex we're having and behaviors that we're doing over time can change genitals in a way that doesn't just have to do with getting the sperm to the egg. And there's some evidence that that may be happening, but nobody's really looked systematically at that.
Rachel Gross, her book is Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Here's an easy way to boost the impact of your monthly gift to KUER. Switch to a direct donation from your bank account. When you do, you'll offset steep processing fees and administrative costs associated with keeping credit and debit cards current. But more importantly, you'll give increased funding to the essential news and stories you depend on. Make the switch today at KUER.org/membership.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the science journalist Rachel Gross. We're talking about her new book, Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. Let's talk about the vaginal canal, which you write about, like how you put it. You write, the vagina is another planet. Talk a little bit about that. One of the ways you help explain all of this, the vagina, is to think about it as a system, as an ecosystem.
So it's kind of funny. I looked at a lot of animal vaginas for the chapter with Patty Brennan in it. But I did hear a few times the human vagina is not super exciting compared to a lot of other species. It's pretty boring. It's like just like the human penis is pretty boring. Like it doesn't do any crazy stuff. But if you look closer under a microscope, it is a teeming ecosystem. You know, microbiome science has gotten a huge kind of boost over the past 10 years or so, and we've learned that pretty much every part of the body has its own unique ecosystem. But the vagina was pretty far behind a lot of other systems for various reasons. And we now know that it's this incredibly important barrier to the outside, sort of a semi-permeable, like liminal space between you and not you. It has to really protect against disease, infection, and keep everything in balance. And to do that, you end up having billions of microbes that a lot of them actually are in the same genus as the ones that changed milk into cheese or yogurt. So lactobacillus, and they create lactic acid, which keeps the vagina at a low, mild acidity, similar to a glass of red wine, which I love.
You say vaginas change day by day, hour by hour. I mean, just the dynamic nature of this ecosystem had not occurred to me.
Me neither. This was kind of a big challenge that people doing vaginal microbiome science found, was that it's always in flux in order to like find homeostasis and get a balance, because it's always interacting with the environment and interacting with like the larger feedback loop of hormones that are happening, because that affects the vaginal environment, what the cells are doing, how much sugar they're making, which affects which bacteria are there. So it really is a dynamic ecosystem.
One of the things that comes up in this part of the book is this idea of transforming, you know, a damaged vaginal ecosystem with these kind of transplants. Talk a little bit about how this idea comes about and how this represents a challenge.
I think this is an idea that stems from thinking of this as an ecosystem that has shifts in it that can be changed for the better. So the first thing that I thought of when I looked into the vaginal microbiome and its discontents was fecal transplants, because I am a science reporter, and that was a crazy time when that was becoming popular and also very scary at first. There was this idea of like the underground brown market and like diseases that could be transferred. And it turns out that the vaginal microbiome is going through a similar boon in how we think about using technology to intervene and optimize it. It's just had many, I don't want to say more challenges, but the researchers that work on this say that they have this double barrier where it's considered like ick, it's vaginas, but also who cares, it's lady problems. And that comes together versus with fecal transplants, you were treating life-threatening diseases in the gut usually. So people were willing to get over the ick factor because they realized how important it was. So this struck me as both a theme of research on female genitals and also just very sad, because I talked to many women who had different types of bacterial infections, some the same as mine, but to such a different degree where it just completely like changed their life. And they were all using that language of shame and feeling contaminated and how what a toll this took on their self-esteem and their relationships. And again, it's so, so common, and there has been no good answer for recurrent infections like this. So I talked to one researcher at Mass General Hospital who is doing some of the first experiments to characterize healthy vaginal environments and to transplant them from one woman to another, which is a challenging type of study to do. Like, there is a lot of like ethics and dark history involved that has to be overcome, but she really believes that this is important enough to women's quality of life.
By dark history, are you referring to James Marion Sims?
I would say he is the dark history behind almost all of gynecology. So the fact that we got this fundamental tool and really like the rise of gynecology as a respected science, a lot of that stemmed out of a slave-owning doctor who made his advancements on the bodies of enslaved women, who, by the way, were essential to pushing this enterprise forward and often acted as surgical assistants and nurses and are kind of erased in history. The specific dark history that I was talking about with vaginal transplants is I looked back at Dr. Gardner. He was a gynecologist in the 50s who did some really nasty and shocking experiments where he transferred vaginal fluid from some women to others. But in his case, he did it from women who were known to have infections to women who didn't. And some of those women were pregnant and they transferred those infections to their husbands. And it's really, really unclear if he got any sort of consent in the modern sense. It appears he did not from what I've seen. But there's like this history of, I mean, everyone has heard of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. Like, you want to be incredibly careful and incredibly transparent if you are doing clinical studies with people's reproductive health.
You see in the book that this the concept of the female body itself is going through this profound transformation. What are you saying?
This was kind of one of the most difficult things for me to wrap my head around, and I'm still wrapping my head around it. I set out thinking I was going to write a book about the science of vaginas or lady parts, but it was really, that was too narrow of a lens, because this book ended up covering every type of body. And I think almost using the female body as a lens into all bodies. So the reason I say that this is undergoing a change is that I think in anatomy and medicine, that dichotomy between male and female has been especially strong. Like in anatomy, you will always see two sexes represented, and in sex education too. And so there is a rapidly changing idea about sex and gender as a spectrum, biologically, culturally, in many different ways. And that is disrupting this huge foundation of human anatomy as kind of a binary science. And it's really inspiring like a lot of rethinking about how bodies differ and how they overlap.
Let me ask you finally, do you think we're approaching a time when we'll have a good name for the vagina?
I guess it depends whether we mean the actual vaginal canal, which I think we do have a good name for, the vagina, or like everything, like the whole outer genitalia or the inner organs. Yeah, I'm super interested in this question and I'm taking all suggestions. My new default is like the reproductive and sexual system, or I like to say vagina et al, or vagina and colleagues. But but yeah, I've heard the argument from the authors of this great book called Pussypedia that pussy is a great word for the female genitals, but since I'm more in the realm of science and medicine, like, you know, I don't see that happening in the conversations I'm thinking of. And I don't see it as specific as what I'm thinking it should be. So it could be that the word vulva takes over as the outer genitals. It could be that we refer to the reproductive system and then the sexual system. But I don't have an answer to that yet. I wish I did.
But at least you're seeing the thinking as being more complicated, taking in how dynamic the system is.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely argue that. I think also there's a growing distinction between parts because the vagina has been the catch-all term that people use. And now I see a lot more people pointing out on social media that you mean the vulva, not the vagina, or defining each one. So definitely that. I think that there is still, in the research world, there is a big focus on fertility, definitely. And there is a neglect of reproductive or vaginal issues that don't kill you or really threaten your fertility. But I think and hope that's changing.
Rachel Gross, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for a really thoughtful discussion. I so appreciate this.
Rachel Gross, her new book is Vagina Obscura, An Anatomical Voyage. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.